Good evening. Welcome to Sunstone's Thursday evening plenary session. We're starting on Mormon time, but we are giving people a chance to find out about the parking here. I'm Jeff Burton. I'll be chairing this session. You may know me. I'm one of the members of the board of directors here, and also the author of the Sunstone's Borderlands column. Any of you read that column ever? I also have a new title. I'm actually known as Elder Burton. This is the truth. I was actually recently called on a service mission. I have a missionary pin and everything. So think about that. Some of you look surprised, and I plan on describing my experience of getting this call in my next Sunstone column. It was quite an interesting experience. So anyway, first a few announcements tonight. We always have to do the announcements. If you have your cell phone with you or a pager, please put it on the offering position. And if you have to take a phone call, please go out in the hall, of course. We want to do thank you for your support of Sunstone and the symposium. We hope you're having a great time. If you're not, you can talk to Toby right down here, or to me. And we do want to mention that the things you've heard about today. If you're interested in lunch. The hotel has a bargain thing that you can buy between sessions and save some time. We'd also like you to visit our vendors, go over to the harvest room, look at their books and so forth. We also have this digitizing project, and we're trying to raise $10,000. We've been asking 100 people to pay $100 each to pay for the cost of digitizing all of the previous presentations and some articles and so forth. Right now we have over 200 tapes have been uploaded to the Sunstone webpage and are available for a free download. We're hoping to get the rest of those done after we reach our goal of the $10,000. So if you're thinking about some place to put some money, think about Sunstone. With that, we'll begin by having an opening hymn led by, of course, our venerable Ardeen Watts. We want to thank him so much for his continued support year after year. We're going to be singing from page 19 of your program. And I've been told that these two songs, opening and closing songs, were two of President McKay's favorites. Thank you. We've asked Brian Mulvey to offer our invocation. I'd like to now introduce to you what we think is going to be a really great treat, a performance piece by Alex Caldiero. It's called Word Shaking. And Alex is a professor at the UVSC in Humanities and Philosophy. And there's a little write-up here that I think is kind of interesting about his performance. This comes from the Saturday session. He'll be also performing again on Saturday at 11:15. But it says, he's a scintillating Sicilian transplant via Brooklyn to Utah County. And word-shaking performer of prodigious poetic delights. And you can find his photograph next to the word outrageous in the dictionary of the avant-garde. So anyway, we want to welcome Alex. We'll give him a time to perform. Thanks.
I usually don't have very good things to say about podium poets, but I'm hoping to shake this up a little bit. And And though, if you noticed, I was there doing it. And then I was in everybody. I don't know. Brush my and then I said, well, you're going to stay, right? Is nobody there? I said, I did both sides. I tell you, mother, it's Neboya Jaya Jaya. I didn't hold your head, your heart, 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 This is the situation. The cats are inside. The dogs are outside. Too old to learn to live together, we keep them separate, or all hell would break loose. If you ask, what efforts have been made to teach them about each other and to introduce them to each other, we'd have to say none. This is the scene. The cats and dogs are kept apart with no idea of cohabitation. I have arrived. I will arrive. We have arrived. We will arrive at this as the only solution. This is the way things are. Dogs outside, cats inside, vigilant over the doors that these worlds may never collide. The real thing looks fake, and the fake thing looks fake. Nor can it be otherwise, as long as eyes look as if by looks alone they are fulfilled. Blood, for instance, is easy to fake. Real blood looks fake, and fake blood looks real. That is, it looks fake. Flowers, for instance, are easy to fake, but it's difficult to make fake flowers look real. Human beings, for instance, act no different whether they are real or fake. Words, for instance, ring the truer the more they become fake. All these subtleties are lost on the likes of me. To Harpo Marx in heaven. You no longer play the harp, nor the piano for that matter, and you speak every chance you get. But this can't be right. This can't be true. In heaven, no one has to talk, and every word is pure music. Where did I get that idea? Why do I have such an idea? Heaven? I don't know anything about the place. I don't even know if it is a place. For all I know, it's a vegetable. Yet, I say it with conviction. I want to go to heaven. I pray to go to heaven, 'cause heaven is good. Heaven is peace. Heaven is light. Where the hell do I get these ideas? I don't know anything about heaven but what I've seen in paintings and read in books. Yet I know it ain't made up. It's real. Heaven is real. Heaven is there. Heaven is waiting to house the righteous. I weep for heaven. Come take me, angels of God. Come take me up to heaven. I say up to heaven, not down. I even know the way. That's how sure I am of it. Take me up, O sweet angels. Take me up to heaven where I can play any instrument. And if Harpo won't play the harp, I will gladly. I'll keep silent and not say a word if Harpo won't. 'Cause I yearn for heaven. I call for heaven. I weep for heaven. O sweet angels, come take me to heaven. Excuse me, may I have a glass of water? I'd like to perform a piece that was actually a letter that I wrote to my good friend Bob in New York in October of 2001. And you don't sound so good. Please take care. Most of this is mental. That's why it's terrorism. It's meant to disconcert, make you revert to blind fear. Poetry is wanted here. And to boot, our homegrown nuts are starting to take root. Yet in most parts, things are calm and generally subdued. But they've been hoaxes and folkses getting anxious and ready to conclude that it's hopeless and drear. Poetry would be helpful here. So I'm going to poetize to realize that you cannot hide when worlds collide. No going inside, no taking a breather either. It all comes in on you at once, and you gotta have at least an ounce of hope and joy to deploy into the atmosphere of fear, to implode the load of grief that's drawing near. Poetry is desired here, 'cause all peoples are, just like you are and I are, close or far are, just people with nowhere to run. Let's stick a flower into every gun, like way back when. Or was that a dream? Can't say now, feeling so low, seeing so bleak, thinking so drear. Songs are needed here, rhythm and timing, a rebirth of cheer. Poetry would be good here. Bam! We are human after all. America, venerable, yet vulnerable, and human after all. That's our real strength. The true meaning of this happenstance, that we can fall and scroll and rise and be surprised and not take for granted the morning sun, so beautiful and dear. Poetry is wanted here. Forgive me for ranting, for panting, for chanting out of tune. That's the fool in me, seeking a tune in me, wanting to stay light and free from what would oppress, depress, regress, obsess, and in general make a mess of my soul. I want to be whole, in control, on a roll, without the slightest hint of fear. Poetry is needed here. So, my dear friend, hang in, hang on, hang tight. We gotta see this to the end. We gotta be concerned and discern the real enemy that we fight. For the veil between truth and lie is become so thin and sheer. Poetry is wanted here.
Hey.
Thank you.
Woo! I don't envy Greg in following that. I'm honored to chair this session and introduce Gregory A. Prince, and he's going to be discussing with us his material from his book, David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism, which is incidentally available from some of our vendors. But I was telling Alex and Paul Swenson earlier that a lot of people here probably think of David O. McKay as their personal president or their personal prophet. Most of us grew up with him as kind of our star. I met President McKay as a child. He actually came to our primary to visit, and he shook all of our hands. This hand actually shook the hand of President McKay. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I had a chance to go up to Huntsville to see some friends, and we went over to his home, and it's still owned by the family. The church hasn't taken it over yet and made it into a missionary tool yet. They open it on weekends, and they usually have one of the descendants of President McKay there to tell you stories and so forth. The house is much like it was when he was there, if you've been there. Again, as I opened doors and so forth with this hand, I was thinking to myself, well, President McKay's hand was probably right on this doorknob. You know, so anyway, It's a great place, and if you get a chance to go up and see it, do that before it gets changed. But let me go on to Gregory Prince. He's one of us. It really feels good to be with you folks. He's been a lifelong member of the church, as I understand. He's currently the high priest group leader in his ward. He's been in several bishoprics, been on a mission, and so forth. He's the co-author of this book that I just mentioned to you with William Robert Wright, and he's also the author of another book which I've got and read and thoroughly enjoyed, Power from On High, The Development of the Mormon Priesthood. He's also a member of the Dialogue Foundation Board. He has a family with three children, two still at home in high school, and he lives in Potomac, Maryland. He's going to speak to us for about 30 to 35 minutes, and then we'll open it up to your questions.
Several years ago, Yogi Berra, the great catcher for the New York Yankees, was honored at a pregame ceremony at home plate at Yankee Stadium. At the conclusion of the award, he was asked to respond, and his response was typically Berra-esque and brief. He said, "I'd like to thank all of those who made this event necessary." I would like to give thanks to the three people who made this event necessary. David O. McKay, who felt and lived that nothing was more important than the truth and his church deserved nothing less, and realized that that meant that all within the church needed to be given the exercise of their free agency to find it wherever it was. To Claire Middlemas, his intrepid secretary, who devoted her life, quite literally, to compiling the record. And to Bob Wright, who brought that record not only to light, but to life. Without all of those three doing their jobs, this biography could not have been written. David O. McKay put up some impressive numbers. 96 years of age, 64 years as a general authority, 19 years as church president, tripling of church membership, first overseas temples, first overseas stakes, and that's an incomplete list. Yet impressive though the numbers are, they belie the greatness of the man and the lasting effect he had over the church as an institution and its individual members. Those who belonged to the church over which he presided remember it nostalgically nearly four decades after his death. I grew up at a time when most people in the church had known George Albert Smith and Heber J. Grant. Some even had known Joseph F. Smith. Yet I never heard anybody remember them in the way nearly all remembered David O. McKay. Those who joined the church or came of age within it after President McKay's death wonder at his lasting effect without understanding it. This year, for the first time since his death, the church curriculum is focusing on his life and teachings, thus affording us an ideal opportunity to examine in depth one of the great men of our entire history. I will focus tonight on what I feel to be one of the cornerstones of his greatness, the means by which he approached the foundation of our church, ongoing revelation. Latter-day Saint revelation is best described as process rather than event. An apt comparison is seen in the work of the late Harvard biologist Stephen Jay Gould, who referred to biological evolution as punctuated equilibrium, consisting of lengthy periods of evolutionary stasis interrupted by occasional bursts of torrential change. Even Joseph Smith's revelations tended to be process punctuated by event. The first vision, for example, was an event in time and space, yet the revelatory content of it evolved for over two decades during Joseph Smith's lifetime, and indeed continued to evolve well beyond his death. A modern example is seen with Spencer W. Kimball. Those who listened carefully in the months following the 1978 revelation on priesthood noted that President Kimball himself referred to the Pentecostal event in the Salt Lake Temple as but the culmination of a process that extended back months, even years. Flashes of inspiration and occasional epiphanies belie the fact that revelation is mostly bought with sweat equity. In a similar manner, revelation during the administration of David O. McKay was process rather than event. Tonight, I would like to discuss as case studies two important revelatory processes that go far to highlight what kind of person and church president he was. Furthermore, they are instructive to us as we deal with the present and future church and to our own lives to the extent that we actually pursue revelation on an individual basis. The first process was the development of the international church. Most of the initiatives in this area came from others, but were embraced by him as he guided the church towards becoming a permanent and significant international presence. His success in this area was unprecedented, and a year prior to his death, he told a reporter from the New York Times that it was the major accomplishment of his presidency. The second process involves blacks and priesthood ordination. In sharp contrast to the first, he consistently rebuffed the suggestions of others to reverse or relax the exclusionary policy that had been followed for over a century. Yet at the same time, he made several private initiatives that were not known at the time, even to his counselors in the first presidency, that helped set the stage for the revelation that occurred 8 years after his death. When David O. McKay became church president in 1951, his experience with the international church was unprecedented. While he shared with each of his predecessors since Brigham Young the experience of having served a mission in a foreign country, two subsequent missions placed him in a unique position. From 1920 to 1921, at the direction of Heber J. Grant, he and Hugh Cannon circumnavigated the globe and visited all of the foreign missions except the South African, with instructions from Grant to obtain general information in order that there may be someone in the deliberations of the First Presidency and the Council of the Twelve thoroughly familiar with actual conditions. Then from 1923 to 1924, he served as president of the European Mission. The international church that McKay saw was not a healthy one. Ever since the church's first proselytizing foray into Upper Canada in the early 1830s, a policy of gathering to Zion plucked the best and brightest Mormon converts from their homelands. By the end of the 19th century, the disappearance of the American frontier, with its abundant and cheap farming land, had combined with the dismantling of the perpetual emigrating fund to diminish the flood of emigrants into the Great Basin. While the number of emigrants dropped, the effect on the international church may actually have been exacerbated, as the people who continued to come to Zion tended to be wealthier and better equipped for leadership, while those staying at home were their mirror image. The international church to which they belonged had no temples, no stakes, poor meeting facilities that often consisted of beer halls and nightclubs, low baptismal rates, and a poor public image. The Great Depression, World War II, and the Korean War had done little to improve conditions. This was the international church that David O. McKay inherited when he became church president in 1951. Within months, he made the international church his top priority. He began with no master blueprint, using instead the analogy of a train moving at night, its lantern illuminating the track for 100 yards. When we reach that point, he said, we will see the next 100 yards. His internal vision consistently drove the agenda, yet the details were generally provided externally by fellow church members who added their own visions, what one may call trickle-up revelation. The first significant development was catalyzed by the president of the British mission, Stainer Richards. A few months after McKay became president, Richards returned briefly from England to attend the funeral of his son who had died of polio. After the funeral, he met with the first presidency and made a plea for a temple in the British Isles, noting its potential for keeping the British saints in their homeland and building a native church. McKay reacted favorably to the request and a short time later announced his decision to the Quorum of the Twelve, noting, quote, that if we build a temple in Great Britain, we should at the same time build one in Switzerland. This latter temple would serve the people in Switzerland, Germany, Austria, and possibly Holland. Never before in the history of the church, and indeed never since, had a temple been built in the location where a stake did not already exist. Mackay thus took a risk, but he was confident that temples in foreign countries, like anchor stores in a mall, would hold people where they were. To borrow from a later popular movie, Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will stay. Having delivered the promise of temple blessings, Mackay was now in a position to end the church policy of gathering. Without fanfare, he began to send the message that the time for emigrating to the United States had ended permanently. On a trip to Europe to select sites for temples in England and Switzerland, Mackay said to a reporter, "We aim to keep our adherents here instead of encouraging them to immigrate to Utah and other places in the United States." At the same time, the First Presidency directed foreign mission presidents to discourage emigration to America. Quote, "It is the present intention of the church to provide temples throughout the world that the members may remain in the areas and yet have the opportunity to receive the blessings of the temple ordinance." Monroe Mackay, a cousin of David O., then serving a mission in South Africa, recalled the letter. "During my mission," he said, "the official announcement to end the gathering came out. We were told to quit singing, 'Think not when ye gather to Zion.'" Another factor that had a major effect on building the international church was the construction of chapels. The problem was summarized by Edgar Brossard, former chairman of the United States Tariff Commission, who spoke of his experiences as a mission president in France in the 1950s. Quote, "President Joseph F. Smith 40 years ago or more said that a good chapel is worth 20 full-time missionaries as a proselyter. I think it's worth more than that in my experience, and in France we don't have them. We meet a lot of wonderful people and have an opportunity to convert them. But imagine how they feel, how shocked, when they bring them to some of our little meeting places where the best we can find to rent is one room, usually in some sort of mediocre club hall, in a basement or upstairs, and in a not very desirable part of town. Sometimes we had to clean the place Sunday morning after their Saturday night parties, open the windows to air out tobacco smoke, pick up empty liquor bottles, clean out spittoons, sweep up litter, empty trash, arrange chairs and furniture and other jobs. The missionaries during the week meet many fine people and go into nice homes where they find the standards they are accustomed to in their own homes. Then on Sunday, they face the awful embarrassment of bringing the investigators to church halls, search services in these rented halls. A lot of wonderful people are waiting for the gospel, but they can't take the letdown that comes when they see our meeting places. Many say, 'We couldn't do that. We couldn't raise our children that way. It's not a church.' Those who do come in are often embarrassed to bring their friends." End quote. As president of the European Mission in 1923, Mackay made reversing the deplorable conditions of meeting facilities a priority, but with no success. To the First Presidency, he gave an unheeded plea: "The crying need of this mission is more respectable buildings in which to hold services." In the decades prior to Mackay's assumption of the presidency in 1951, three factors had combined to forestall any meaningful international building program. The first was the Great Depression, whose effects were no less devastating in Utah than elsewhere. Total church-wide expenditures on buildings, which included construction and maintenance, were only $890,000 in 1930, and by 1935 sank by nearly two-thirds to $320,000. By contrast, 20 years later, the first year of Wendell Mendenhall's tenure as chairman of the building department, expenditures were nearly 100-fold higher. The second factor was World War II, as the war effort put most other construction projects, particularly churches, on indefinite hold. And the third factor was J. Reuben Clark, Jr. Clark was the powerful and autocratic counselor to church presidents Heber J. Grant from 1933 until Grant's death in 1945, and George Albert Smith from 1945 until Smith's death in 1951. As both presidents suffered declining health for several years prior to their death, Clark stepped in as the de facto church president, overshadowing Second Counselor Mackay. Fiscally conservative, Clark made no secret of his aversion to what he viewed as exuberant spending on buildings. Addressing the General Conference in 1940, he said, "I think we have a tendency to make our buildings just a little too elaborate and too ornate." In 1950, Clark acted unilaterally and abruptly imposed a moratorium on new chapel construction. While wartime exigencies and Clark's frugality frustrated McKay's vision of church buildings, they nonetheless laid the foundation for the building boom that accompanied McKay's ascension to the presidency. Arch Madsen, who later headed the church's broadcasting empire, recounted, "President Henry D. Moyle once told me that the church had built up quite a reserve during the war years, and they had a tendency to hold on to that. President McKay didn't believe in that, and neither did President Moyle." A McKay family member added, "As a result, there was money in banks all over the United States. The church was hoarding cash, and President McKay said, 'Ah, we've got to get buildings built.' And that's what the reverse in direction was." Over a period of 3 years, McKay made two moves that laid the foundation for unprecedented chapel construction throughout the world. The first came in 1952, when he removed the building program from the portfolio of the presiding bishopric and placed it directly under the first presidency. The second came in 1955, when Howard McKean, chairman of the building committee since 1946, died unexpectedly of a heart attack. McKay replaced him with a rancher from California, Wendell Mendenhall, whose activities in assisting building projects in New Zealand had impressed him. Mendenhall was a visionary and energetic man. One colleague recalled, "He was just a very powerful man. If he saw something that needed to be done, it got done. Once he decided he was going to do it, it didn't make any difference what was in the way. He would do it." But perhaps the most important factor in his success was that, like his predecessor since 1952, he reported directly to McKay and thus circumvented the church's bureaucracy. And he had McKay's personal confidence. Alan Blodgett, who later became the church's chief financial officer, stated that under Mendenhall's leadership, the building program, quote, "took off like a shot. The church had built up large financial reserves during the war years, and Mendenhall believed that these resources could be better deployed building the kingdom." The calling of Henry Moyle to the first presidency in 1959 stoked the fires of the construction program. And in 1963, in a tribute to McKay's 90th birthday, Moyle summarized the extraordinary accomplishments of the program. "In the past 12 years," he said, "under the direction of the first presidency of the church, we have built 56% of the 3,500 meeting houses we now have in the world, 1,941 in number, more than were built in the preceding 120 years of church history." The image of the church in foreign countries, particularly Western Europe, had been poor for a full century prior to McKay's presidency, ever since the public acknowledgement of the practice of plural marriage in 1852. While McKay's persona did much to improve that image, it was eclipsed in Europe by the 1955 tour of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, a tour that had been suggested by one of McKay's friends. Although the choir was well known and respected within the United States, both from its weekly broadcast programs and occasional national tours, it had never ventured overseas. In 1953, following the public announcement of the temple in Switzerland, a church member approached McKay with the proposal to send the choir to Europe at the time of the temple's dedication. McKay's diary notes, "President McKay mentioned that Jack Thomas had called on him yesterday and said he had never been on a mission, but there's one thing he would like to do which he felt would be a great missionary factor, and that he would have a year and a half to work it out. He said he would like to take the Tabernacle Choir to Switzerland when the temple is there is dedicated, and hold concerts in London and Paris and other centers. He said it would cost $250,000, and that he would raise every cent of it and not call on the church for $1. The president said the more he thought about it, the more favorably he was impressed. The choir gave concerts in London and Paris prior to the dedication of the Swiss temple in 1955, and the result was dramatic. The president of the French mission reported, "Before the choir came to Europe, the newspaper articles in France were very often, but not always, unfavorable to the church. However, as soon as the choir had sung the first concert in Europe, the articles were more or less neutral, just quoting what others had said. Then, after the choir had sung in Paris, the newspaper articles became most favorable. There were 125 newspaper write-ups on the concert itself, and these articles have been sent to the historian's office in the church office building. Since that time, nearly all the articles have been favorable, and none has been slanderous. We think the choir is one of the greatest things that ever hit Europe. Another factor that lifted the church's public image abroad was the upgrading of mission homes by Henry Moyle, a project he undertook shortly after joining the First Presidency in 1959. One general authority described Moyle's vision. He had the idea of getting the Mormon image out of the gutter. Mission homes back before he took over were kind of dumpy places around the world, and he went into the palatial concept. When I was down coordinating the South Pacific, he bought a mission home in Christchurch, which is the show place of all New Zealand. It had acres and acres of park and this big palace in there. All of a sudden, people in New Zealand took notice of the Mormon church and said, "Who are these people?" Well, he did that in many, many parts of the world. Having served as a mission president, I could see the value of it because it enhanced what I was doing with people in town. I had entree to people you don't normally have entree to," end quote. While proselytizing efforts in Europe had been enormously successful in the 19th century, two world wars, the Great Depression, the Korean War, and other factors combined to put the brakes on 20th century missionary success. The situation began to change in the mid-1950s when a successful, hard-charging businessman by the name of Alvin Dyer was called to preside over the Central States Mission. Dyer quickly discarded the didactic approach to proselytizing, which generally required months of teaching before converts were accepted for baptism, and relied instead on an emotional, spiritual conversion process. "There's too much hedging in our approach," he said. "Drive to the point." One man who bought into Dyer's approach was his counselor in the mission presidency, a former Utah who had moved to Kansas during World War II to preside over a defense contracting company. In 1958, T. Bowring Woodbury was called as president of the British mission, and within a short time, he revolutionized missionary work within the church, albeit not without controversy. Combining Dyer's method of conversion with his own high-intensity sales techniques, Woodbury drove his missionaries to previously unimaginable accomplishments, with many other missions throughout the world following suit. His insatiable appetite for ever higher goals eventually caused tragedy, yet the authentic results underlying the tragedy laid the foundation for a lasting church presence internationally. A year after Woodbury went to England, Alvin Dyer was called as president of the European mission and Henry Moyle as a counselor in the First Presidency. Moyle gave the two subordinates full encouragement and added his own flavor to the missionary program by calling young, dynamic mission presidents in the prime of their careers rather than the retirees that previously had been the mainstay of the program. All the while, David O. McKay watched and approved the initiatives of those who served under him, Stainer Richards and Foreign Temples, Wendell Mendenhall and acceleration of the building program, Jack Thomas and the triumphant tour of the Tabernacle Choir, Henry Moyle, Alvin Dyer, and Bowring Woodbury and the invigorated missionary program. It was a model of external revelation, with most of the ideas coming from those surrounding McKay and his role being coordination of the whole. In 1955, the first temple outside North America was dedicated in Switzerland, with two more to follow. Temples, in turn, provided a solid base upon which to construct a permanent church, and in 1959, the first stake outside North America was formed in New Zealand, with many others in Europe and South America to follow. It was trickle up rather than trickle down, and it worked. In sharp contrast to the development of the international church, the issue of blacks and priesthood ordination was intensely internal for McKay. At no point in his 19-year tenure as president did he make a public statement even suggesting that he might challenge the century-old ban on ordination of blacks. He responded with silence to repeated requests and demands from outsiders that the policy be changed. To insiders, most notably his first counselor, Hubie Brown, who saw the opening of Nigeria to missionary work as an opportunity to give blacks the Aaronic priesthood. He responded that the policy could only be changed by revelation, and no such revelation had come. McKay's consistent opposition to the civil rights movement led to the assumption by many that he was not sympathetic to changing the policy and that he did nothing to alter the status quo. However, from 1954 until a year or so before his death, McKay quietly re-examined the policy, nibbled at its periphery, and repeatedly took it to the source to see if the time had come for change. Yet he did so in virtual privacy, rarely tipping his hand even to his counselors within the first presidency. In 1954, McKay became the first general authority ever to visit the South African mission, a mission that had been formed a century earlier. His visit was for the purpose of examining firsthand the effect of a policy that was begun in the late 1940s that required all male priesthood members to trace all their ancestral lines back to Europe prior to priesthood ordination. Genealogical records were often inadequate, and despite the full-time detailing of 6 missionaries to assist members, few were successful in completing their research. As a result, the mission was hamstrung by the shortage of local priesthood leadership. McKay's trip resulted in 4 important outcomes. First, at a missionary conference on the spot, he reversed the policy on genealogical research, stating that men would be presumed not to have black ancestry unless there was compelling evidence to the contrary. He made this decision on the spot, informing his counselors of it after the fact by letter. The effect on the mission was immediate and dramatic. The other 3 outcomes occurred shortly after his return to Salt Lake City. First, in a private meeting with Sterling McMurrin on another issue, McKay stated explicitly, and perhaps for the first time, that the ban on ordination of blacks was, quote, a practice, not a doctrine, and the practice will someday be changed, end quote. Second, he appointed a committee within the Quorum of the 12 to re-examine the historical basis of the policy. And finally, he took the matter to the Lord, apparently for the first time. Leonard Arrington referred to the incident in his autobiography. Quote, I knew something about the apostolic study because I heard Adam S. Benyon, who was a member of the committee, refer to the work in an informal talk he made to the Mormon seminar in Salt Lake City on May 13, 1954. McKay, Benyon said, had pled with the Lord without result and finally concluded that the time was not yet ripe. On several other occasions, McKay nibbled at the periphery of the policy without changing it. He reversed the ban on ordination of Fijian males whose black skin had previously disqualified them. He authorized temple marriages for some who were thought to have black African ancestry, choosing to act on the side of mercy and saying, whenever we can face our Heavenly Father and say we did this and can justify ourselves, why I feel I can sleep. And on at least one occasion, he authorized the ordination to the Aaronic priesthood of a young man with unambiguous black African ancestry. The stake president recalled the incident. Quote, one of our fine bishops presiding in the Cincinnati ward was gravely concerned over the plight of one of the young boys in the ward. Bruce had grown up in the ward, and his fellows were approaching the age when they would be ordained deacons. Bruce would not be among them. His father had, during military service, met and married a very flamboyant beauty on the island of Barbados. This lady, Bruce's mother, was unquestionably of mixed blood. His bishop was like a plague of locusts, constantly harassing me to write to President McKay about this matter. Of course, I was reluctant. Finally, I yielded to his importuning and wrote to President McKay, explaining the situation in considerable detail. Within a short time, I received a reply. I cannot now recall whether President McKay signed the letter or whether it was his secretary, but probably the former. President McKay's instructions were very direct. Ordain the young man. Incredulous, I did something stupid. I wrote back, stating perhaps I had not made the situation clear, and attempted again to explain that Bruce definitely had Negro blood. Again, I received a very specific answer. Ordain the young man. Not content with an occasional exception to the rule, McKay approached the Lord on several occasions in an attempt to have it reversed. His earliest inquiry, as far as we have record, was referred to earlier and occurred in 1954, shortly after his return from South Africa. Other inquiries followed, though generally the dates are not known. On one occasion, his daughter-in-law, Mildred Calderwood McKay, who served on the general board of the primary, expressed her anguish that black male children who commingled with white children during their primary years were excluded from the Aaronic priesthood when they turned 12. "Can't they be ordained also?" she asked. He replied sadly, "No." "Then I think it's time for a new revelation," she said. He answered, "So do I." Marion D. Hanks, a general authority called by McKay in 1953, spoke with him in the late 1960s prior to traveling to Vietnam to visit LDS servicemen. Hanks related an incident from a prior trip to Vietnam in which he had comforted a wounded black LDS soldier. And as he told the story, he noted that tears were coming down McKay's face. Referring to the priests of Ban, McKay said, "I have prayed and prayed and prayed, but there has been no answer." Lola Timmons, who was with us tonight, a secretary in President McKay's office from 1961 to 1968, recalled a day when he returned from a meeting with the First Presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve in the temple. The subject had come up in several such meetings, and on this occasion, he said to the secretaries that he had inquired of the Lord several times on the matter, and the answer was, "Not yet." But the most remarkable account came from Richard Jackson, an architect who served in the church building department from 1968 through the time of McKay's death in 1970. He said, "I remember one day that President McKay came into the office. We could see that he was very much distressed. He said, 'I've had it. I'm not going to do it again.' Somebody said, 'What?' He said, 'Well, I'm badgered constantly about giving the priesthood to the Negro. I've inquired of the Lord repeatedly. The last time I did was late last night. I was told with no discussion not to bring the subject up with the Lord again, that the time will come, but it will not be my time, and to leave the subject alone.' We were all, of course, a little numbstruck. I don't think it has ever been written that that happened. I've never told anybody about that. I can still see him coming in with a bit of a distraught appearance, which was unusual for President McKay. He always appeared as if he had everything under control." On no occasion did McKay make public his wrestling with the issue, and inexplicably, he chose not to discuss it even with his counselors. As a result, most church members until now assumed that no president prior to Spencer Kimball bothered to ask the question, and few appreciated the groundwork prepared by McKay that underlay the 1978 revelation to his successor. Two important subjects within the McKay presidency, two different models of revelation. In the case of the International Church, much of the revelatory process relied upon input from McKay's colleagues, and McKay openly welcomed their suggestions, at no time threatened by any attitude of "not invented here." Yet in the case of the policy on blacks and priesthood ordination, he held his cards close, neither soliciting nor welcoming suggestions from others, including his own counselors within the First Presidency. What are the lessons for today's church and for today's church members? There are several. First, revelation, the means by which the church evolves, occurs in multiple forms, but with the common denominator of process rather than event. The process may result in nearly continual change, as in the case of the International Church, or apparent stasis despite years of behind-the-scenes activity, as in the case of the priesthood ban. Second, the forces driving the process of revelation may be external, as in the case of the International Church, or internal, as in the case of the priesthood ban. Third, where external forces are involved, The process of revelation is as likely to be trickle up as trickle down. While the case in point is the international church, one needn't look far to see many other cases where church-wide change came about through the initiative of one or a few grassroots members. The example of Stainer Richards and foreign temples is replicated in the genesis of the Relief Society, Sunday School, Mutuals, Primary, Institutes of Religion, Young Adults, and many other church programs, each of which began as grassroots initiatives that succeeded locally and were then appropriated by the entire church. Fourth, while the church is a highly centralized organization, there is still the need for input from the best and brightest of its members. Good ideas can originate anywhere, and there is an obligation for church members with gifts to bring them to the altar, though not to dictate their fate thereafter. And finally, what works for the institution also works for the individual. Guidance in personal matters may come from without or from within. And while it may take the form of event, and many have experienced such, it is likely to take the form of process, with a gradual resolution of a problem occurring over months or years. Thus, the study of revelatory models during the administration of David O. McKay, which is made possible because of the richness of the record of that era, now available for examination, may lead not only to an appreciation of how we as a church got to be where we are, but also to an awareness of how to navigate our own course through life. Thank you.
We have time to take some of your questions, and I'd like to suggest that you keep your comment or your question short so that we'll hear from as many as we can. Also, I've got a note here from Kurt Bench that says that he's indicated that he's going to stay open after the session if you're interested in seeing some of these books.
He wants you to more than see them. Don't all speak at once.
Because we are taping this, if you have a question or comment, you must come to the podium, up to the microphone, if you would. Thanks.
My high school seminary teacher finished his CES career working at 50 East North Temple, and he told me that President McKay had a habit every now and again of just wandering through the building and stopping in and talking with people, and then would ask them questions like, "What would you think if?" And that happened to my seminary teacher. Do you have any further insights into this habit of his of soliciting candid comments and suggestions amongst the church membership?
No, I don't. Lola, can you add anything to that?
The building at 50 East North Temple wasn't built until after he passed away.
Yeah. 47 East North Temple was built.
47 East South Temple.
Okay, well, that must have been it.
No, I never saw him wander around and do that, but he would always talk to people in the halls.
Yeah, okay. Since she didn't get on the microphone, her response was that she doesn't recall him wandering around, but he would talk to people in the halls. And the whole atmosphere then, in a different world than we live in now, was very different. You could walk into...
We didn't have security.
Yeah. Walk right into Claire's office. That's where the security began. Far more daunting than current-day security measures. Yeah, Mike?
Yeah, Greg, I think you do a good job of talking about process and obviously McKay's... goodwill and with respect to the issue of blacks in the priesthood, but look at it from a perspective of just sheer power. After looking at all the documentation that you've reviewed in writing this biography, do you think McKay had the necessary power that he could have made a unilateral decision to reverse what he referred to as a policy versus a practice?
No. And this is where the people closest to him greatly misunderstood in the months prior to his death. They didn't know that he had made that statement to Sterling McMurrin in 1954. When that came to light and President McKay verified it, they made the assumption that if he called it policy, it could be changed by administrative action. He never said that, and in fact, when pressed, would say, it will take a revelation to change the policy. He was very careful, and Lola, I presume you can answer for this. In general, he was extremely careful with his use of the English language. He was very precise, and when he said policy, he consistently used that word to mean the same thing. He never used the word doctrine in reference to what he called a policy. And the differentiation in his mind was, had it been doctrine, don't bother to ask. As a policy, it was okay to ask, but you couldn't act on that until and if the answer came through. So he made it clear to others around him that he did not have that power. Paul Dunn told me of a meeting in the temple, and Bernard Brockbank had raised the question. And President McKay got a little agitated and said, you phrase your question as if I'm the one who makes that decision. He said, I'm not. I have to come up to the microphone again, or the chairman will extract a pound of flesh from me.
If in fact, then it was a policy, isn't it a little troubling that there was not more effort to articulate the basis for the policy? As I review the record, it was really Lester Bush that finally did the work and created a foundation
for
which the decision could be made. If McKay really, if one of those 4 points that you mentioned in your speech was to look at the historical basis for the policy, isn't it troubling to you that more effort wasn't made in that regard?
I don't know if more effort would have led them to any more certainty about it. I think the whole thing was muddy. I don't think that there is a point in the sand back in the 1840s or 1850s when you can say this is when the policy came into being and this is why. And that's why it became so difficult to try to sort it out retroactively. If you look very carefully at his statements to the press in two sequential trips to Europe, both were in the UK in press conferences. The first one, which is about 1958, he stated his belief about what the policy rested upon 4 or so years later when he stated that he had distanced himself from that. He was no longer as sure of what the received version was as he had been initially. And I just don't think that anybody perhaps didn't have enough access to documentation to know. You rightly point out that Lester's groundwork on it was phenomenal and certainly went beyond what they had been able to do before. Yes?
You mentioned, and as part of your tour through President McKay's successful administration, the rapid increase in chapel building throughout the world and sort of left us there like it was on an upward spiral, and the church had the resources to do it. I recall hearing, this is nothing official, that got out of, the chapel building got ahead of the fundraising of the funds available to where the point where the church was borrowing money actually for the first time since J. Reuben Clark had taken over finances, I guess.
Yeah, a couple of comments on that. First is there were two spirals going on simultaneously, the building program and the missionary program. Both of them spiraled out of control at about the same time for different reasons. You point out correctly that it was financial for the chapels, and what had happened was that the growth was so quick that the methodology for keeping pace with the growth hadn't kept pace. So there were allegations at the time that there was corruption. I don't think that there were. The people I've spoken to who knew the finances said, no, that wasn't the case. There was mismanagement because they didn't know how to operate this machine that had gotten so large so quickly. And they did get beyond themselves financially. Many of you who have lived in this area can remember when they excavated the basement for what now is the church office building and built it up to a certain point, and then it got mothballed for a couple of years. Well, the reason was that's when the cash crunch hit. Now, it wasn't a question of the church going into bankruptcy or even going near bankruptcy. Not the case at all. Alan Blodgett, who was right in the middle of the finances, said, we had plenty of assets. Problem was, it was all in real estate. So the real problem we faced was one of cash flow, and what we had to do was put the brakes on. And he said, you only had to do it for about one building cycle, which was about 6 months. He said, by that time, we had caught up on the cash flow, and we had reworked the accounting systems and the distribution systems so that it now was appropriate for the level of building we were doing. He said, then on we went. Unfortunately, there were some casualties along the way, as there were in the missionary program. But there's no question in either case that those programs and their meteoric ascent during those few years propelled the international church to where it is now. It couldn't have gotten there otherwise. So nothing was black and white all the way. Yeah, John?
With your patience, I have two questions, actually. As I've read Michael Quinn's Extensions of Power, I seem to recall he discusses how decisions get made by the First Presidency of the Quorum of the Twelve, and it's by consensus. And so there's a lot of sort of back channel, one-to-one in office building, sort of coalition building that happens. And usually a vote isn't even proposed until someone sort of knows that they likely have the votes to sort of make some big type of change. And an example of this was when Harold B. Lee was out of town in around 68, when they actually voted to rescind the ban. And that got squashed when Harold B. Lee came back into town. So my first question is there any indication that that David O. McKay sort of defined revelation coming as not just revelation to him? Maybe the revelation did come to him, but what he meant by the revelation not coming is that it hadn't come to Harold B. Lee, and it hadn't come to Ezra Taft Benson, and it hadn't come to Joseph Fielding Smith and some of the other brethren who would never have voted in a consensual way, potentially, for
that. No, in his private conversations, including the ones that I've quoted here, he made it very explicit. The word had come to him, not yet. It wasn't that it hadn't come to somebody else. Now, understand, first of all, your initial statement may be what Mike Quinn said, but it doesn't jive with reality. Yes, sometimes that's the way decisions are made in the First Presidency, and sometimes it's not. Understand that the church today is a very different church administratively than it was under David O. McKay. Today, as far as I understand it, there are only two programs that report directly to the First Presidency. One is the Special Affairs Committee and the other is the temples. Somebody can correct me if I'm off on that. Everything else reports in a line fashion to the Quorum of the Twelve. In the McKay Presidency, nothing went to the Quorum of the Twelve. It all went to the First Presidency. And it was up to the President to decide how he wanted to make the decisions. Certainly, on many occasions, he would bring it before his counselors and the Quorum of the Twelve to get the consensus. On several important occasions, he made the decision and they found out about it later. Mm. So it's highly dependent on the President. In today's church, it's not a stretch to say that we have moved from a monarchy to a parliamentary government, in the sense that with President McKay and his predecessors, you had one man who, if you can pardon the analogy, was the head of state and the head of government. Now what you have is President Hinckley, who clearly is the head of state. But the day-to-day workings of the church, all of these programs, where they filter to the head of government, the prime minister, is Boyd Packer. A very different church. And you can argue the pluses or minuses. That may have been inevitable once the church reaches a certain size. It was pretty big then to manage it that way, but it was still being done. And so then it was the prerogative of the president. That's where the buck stopped. If he wanted to make it a matter of discussion and consensus amongst the quorum, then he did it. In President McKay's case, there were some times when he didn't.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah. Now, and even today, there is nothing that would stop President Hinckley from getting up at the pulpit and saying, it was this way, now it's this way. And I think that you'd find a pretty wide level of acceptance to that, even amongst the quorum.
Okay. Thank you. So my second, I was very intrigued by the role of Hubie Brown in this whole affair. I was almost disappointed to read that he sort of went public in 62, was it, with the New York Times, predicting that the ban would be, and I almost felt like maybe he might have prolonged a bit the decision by trying to sort of corner David O. McKay and sort of put him, I don't know if he did that intentionally or what. But
who knows? There you're trying to crawl into somebody's mind or several people's mind. I don't know if that delayed it.
But what I was super sad about was to hear that he was released when Joseph Fielding Smith became prophet. Yeah. And I know some members of that family, the McConkie Fielding family, and I asked them if they shared that view as to that being why he was released. And they didn't seem to share that view. And so I was wondering whether there was additional details or
facts. That came from members of the Brown family. So take it for whatever it's worth.
And those are the only sources.
What is not up for discussion is this is for the first time in a century, more than a century, that a counselor in the first presidency was not retained by the succeeding president. The last time that happened was at the death of Brigham Young.
And was that the Brown family's feeling, or was that what they were told, someone was told?
It's what Ed Firmage told me.
Okay. Thank you.
And he didn't nuance it. He said, this is why grandfather was released.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk to Ed tomorrow. David.
Greg, I just wanted to comment on your comment about punctuated evolution and how things, when they do change...
Punctuated equilibrium is the phrase that Gould coined.
Can move with precipitous speed. I was a missionary in Scotland, 1949-51, and was there when Stainer Richards asked us to start looking for church properties. The first year I was a missionary, we had 12 baptisms in all of Scotland. We acquired a beautiful townhouse in Glasgow and another in Edinburgh. These were big places that in the post-war period the English gentry could no longer afford to keep up. And they made wonderful sort of first church properties. And the second year, when we had these lovely properties to meet in and to bring people to MIA and so on, we had over 106 baptisms. It really made a difference. This is the process you're talking about.
There's always this balance between image and substance.
Oh.
And you can't do without either one, and if you get too far out of balance, things don't function smoothly.
What you said about being embarrassed to bring some of our better investigators to church is so true.
Yeah.
We were meeting in railroad stations. We were meeting in lodges, you know, beer halls, in effect. And when we could go to these lovely townhouses, it just made all the difference. Now, I was back in Britain professionally just 4 years later. And by that time, under Stainer Richards, we already had a purpose-built chapel in Withenshaw, Lancashire. And that was a second step up.
Yeah.
And you see, all of this within 5 years, the punctuated, what was the word you wanted to use?
Punctuated equilibrium.
Punctuated equilibrium, but when the equilibrium was broken, boy, the speed just accelerated.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd like to ask you two questions. Number one, would you comment about Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon doctrine and how President McKay felt about that and apparently was not able to prevent him from... Anyway, would you just speak about that?
That wasn't two questions, was it?
Well, that's just one question. Do you want to answer the first one, then I'll ask you a second?
Or? Let me hear them both, then I get
okay,
two.
And the second question, I've heard it said that President McKay did not believe in the historicity of the Book of Mormon. Would you please comment on that?
Let me take the first one first.
Okay.
The book, Mormon Doctrine, was published without the knowledge, not just of President McKay, but Joseph Fielding Smith, Brother McConkie's father-in-law. It did not have, obviously, the approval, because it didn't even have the knowledge of the other general authorities. And because of the content of it, particularly comments relating to Roman Catholicism, it proved to be a greatly embarrassing book. One of the first people I interviewed in preparing the biography was David King, who is now the Patriarch in our stake in Washington, D.C. Many of you who have been in Utah for years know him because he was a several-term congressman in Utah, also was ambassador to Madagascar and Mauritius in the Johnson administration. Wonderful, very bright guy. He said he was first elected to the Congress in November 1958, which is just when that book came out. He said the first person who came to congratulate me was Dwayne Hunt, who was the Catholic Bishop of Salt Lake City. And he said he had a copy of Brother McConkie's book in his hand and tears rolling down his cheek and says, "We're your friends. We don't deserve this." And because of that, largely, the book was taken off the shelves. It wasn't until 1966, under, I think, strained circumstances, that Elder McConkie decided that he could go ahead and publish it again. If you read in the book, and read it carefully, his rendition of what President McKay said and the official memo of the meeting were different. President McKay's diary said, "Should you decide to publish this, it will be your responsibility." The memo that McConkie wrote to Claire Middlemouth said, "President McKay said, I should publish this." Question number two, what about the historicity of the Book of Mormon? There is nothing in the McKay record coming from President McKay directly that suggests that. There is one account attributed to Hugh Nibley, so it's secondhand, that might put that question forward. The problem is that's hanging out there in isolation with nothing else to support it. And being in a vacuum like that, I don't know what to do with that statement. It doesn't pass the test of being solid enough evidence even to say anything about it. I'm not trying to dodge the issue. That's the data point, and it's secondhand. And there is nothing in the entire record, and believe me, I looked deeply and interviewed deeply, that even comes remotely close to that. I don't know what to do with it.
So, just in response to this gentleman quickly, I'm from Glasgow, and the building he's referring to is on Claremont Terrace, the townhouse, and it's regarded with a great deal of sentimentality with the older members who were pretty upset at the time that it was sold off and replaced with a building on Julian Avenue. So you're quite correct. My question for you is, when you portray David O. McKay, you...
Go ahead and say McKay, we know what that means. Don't try to...
When you portray David O. McKay, and when others portray David O. McKay, and I'm far too young to remember him in any way, the portrayal is often that he seems kind of like a very progressive liberal character. My question is, do you think if indeed you believe that to be true, do you think he would be comfortable in today's more autocratic church?
I don't like to put easy labels on anybody. And what I found after looking at all of the characters in this drama, and there were some powerful personalities in there, nobody gets a black hat. And nobody really gets a snow white hat. It's all shades of gray as it is for all of us. On some issues, I think, was way ahead of his times. On other issues, he was strictly a man of his times. What do you do with that? You can't make a generalization that'll hold. What would he think of today's church? I think a more interesting question is, would Joseph Smith recognize today's church? But that's not really the litmus test, is it? Because the whole point of what we're talking about here is revelation. If you really believe that, now we got a lot of people in the church, everybody in favor of revelation, everybody in favor of change. You don't get the one without the other. And so if you had a church today that was no different than the church that he left, perhaps his comment would be, what have you guys been doing? It has to evolve because times have changed and people have changed, even though what we're talking about of the essence of Mormonism is unchanging. The form that it takes had better change or it's going to become irrelevant. Does that answer the question adequately?
Kind of. He's known for, like you say, asking the members to grow rather than being asked to conform.
Yeah.
And it seems like in the past couple of years, 20 years or so, that the church has kind of gone back on that and is putting more of an emphasis on conformity rather than personal growth, in my opinion. And so I meant that kind of thing rather than, you know, so...
I think one of the opportunities that we have, and one of the reasons that I was eager once I got into the project to complete it, is to be able to look back at that and say, maybe there's some things that we need to revisit. Those were really good years. And if there are some things that maybe we need to borrow, let's do it. Yeah. I got no problem with that.
I heard or read somewhere that the years of President David O. McKay's administration were marked by the development of a cult personality towards the president of the church. And I think I even read that he kind of encouraged that. What is your response to that?
My observation, now I'll put the disclaimer, I grew up in the church. I was born in 1948. But I grew up in Los Angeles, so I never met President McKay. He was a continual presence in our lives, broadcast of General Conference, you know, the improvement era. It was all there, but I never met him personally. I don't get the sense in all of the research that I've done and talking with a lot of people, about 200 of them, who knew him well, that he tried to do that. I think that his persona was such that it lent that to the church. Here is this man who, on occasion, when he walked into the room, would electrify the room, even if it was a room full of non-members. Well, what do you do with that? You've got it or you don't. The word charisma is overused, not in his case. I don't think that it's an overstatement at all to say that this is one of the most charismatic men of our times. He was certainly aware of the importance of image. No question about that. He was immaculately groomed. That was not an accident. But I don't think that he ever did anything to encourage a cult following. Lola, step to the microphone, please, because you knew him better than anybody in the room. Lola worked in his office for 7 years. So let's go to the source here.
He was so sincere and so loyal to God that he didn't think about himself. A lot of people would approach him and say, you look like an angel, because he did. And I remember running into his office one day as taking him some notes to take to the council meeting in the temple. He was dressed in his white clothes. I walked into the room and I fell into his arms. And all I could think of, he's an angel, because he looked the part. He looked like a prophet, probably more than anybody we've ever had as a prophet in the church. And you felt it in his presence, too.
That statement that you've made, I have heard, and all of us have heard, he looked like a prophet. Now, think about that. Think about it in two ways. Number one, have you heard any other church president referred to with those terms? I never have, before or since. Number two, what is the image of a prophet that the rest of the world would have? A bearded Old Testament man wearing a robe, right? So what's going on here, he defined a paradigm that nobody before or since has quite matched. But he didn't call him, he didn't say, hey guys, I look like a prophet. He was what he was. And there were occasions, as I said, where he would enter a room or enter a scene where people didn't know who he was, and yet the action would freeze before he'd even said a word. That didn't happen all the time, but it only needs to happen once, and you realize this is an extraordinary person.
When President McKay was struggling with the issue of blacks in the priesthood.
Yep.
Obviously, he was struggling with it for some time, from what you said. Did he ever ask people, or did he ever refer to the fact that Joseph Smith had given the Melchizedek priesthood to some blacks? Or did he ever wonder when and why and by whom Joseph Smith's policy had been reversed?
No, and I think the reason goes back to what was said earlier. Nobody really understood all of that. Those data points were buried out there, and it wasn't until the 1970s that Lester Bush came along and finally assembled enough of the puzzle that you could start to see that picture emerge.
Joseph Smith's policy was never...
Nobody knew about it then.
Mentioned.
President McKay did not know that there was a policy.
Oh, really?
Until 1921, by which time he had been an apostle for 15 years. Okay,
yes.
That's how well understood the whole thing was. Get the point?
Yes. Yes, thank you. This hand shook his hand also.
I got to shake a couple of hands. It's the closest I'll get.
You mentioned the changes that came about in the European mission to make missionary work have more effect. I wonder if you deal in the book, and I'm ashamed to say I haven't read it yet, but if you deal in the book with some of the possibly adverse things that occurred. You mentioned President Woodbury, as I'm sure you know. Time magazine did a piece called they had a photograph of President Woodbury and his wife, and the caption was "Buying bubbles, have baptism, will travel," and the implication was that sort of a retail salesmanship was going on. When I came back from Sweden, where I was served on a mission, I talked with a missionary who came back after a couple years after me, and it was during the time when Alvin Dyer was the president of the European Mission, and he described a situation in Sweden where missionaries felt under so much pressure to baptize that they were told to, one day they were told to go out and not come back until they had commitment, at least one commitment for baptism from someone. And during that day, supposedly, from what I was told by this missionary, some got thrown downstairs. There were some bad things. And after that, there was a mission conference at which President Dyer spoke. And according to the missionary who told me this story, he said President Dyer held up a Book of Mormon in one hand and a plane ticket in the other and said, you can follow what we're attempting to do here, or you can choose not to serve her anymore. And the story went that a missionary from the southern states in the back of the hall said, "Elder Dyer." Then he walked up to the front of the hall and he said, "I'm going home." He took the plane ticket. I just wonder if you deal with any of those adverse effects that
so you spoiled
may have occurred.
The story. I thought you were going to say he didn't say where the ticket was to.
Yes, well...
The answer to your...
Yeah, I don't know where he went after he took the ticket, but he,
the
said,
answer
he, was,
to your lengthy,
he said he was going home.
Answer to the lengthy question is yes.
Okay, good. Well, I'll look for that.
In considerable detail it's
Thank
dealt
you.
With.
Thank you.
Yeah. One more question, and then you get to go home.
Unless I missed something, I think what you have described to us tonight is fundamentally a contradiction. You have talked about President McKay being quite easy about revelation. It comes through this trickle-up process, as opposed to his listening for a voice, a very subjective kind of voice, through a glass darkly, perhaps we'd say, and insisting on some kind of... Mm-hmm. fence that it had to meet. This sounds like...
No, it's not a contradiction at all.
A contradiction. Well, let me add, here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
How do you explain in his own mind what was going on in these two processes, and why do they seem so different?
Okay, that's the whole point, is that there are different processes. Avery Dulles is an emeritus professor at Catholic University. I believe he's a Jesuit scholar. He's the son of John Foster Dulles. He wrote a book 25 years or so ago called Models of Revelation in the Roman Catholic context. His point is very apropos to what we're talking about here. It is not a monolith. This process can come from various directions that may depend on the person who's doing the asking. It may depend on what the nature of the beast happens to be at the time. When I used the term trickle up, that was with reference to the international church. It's not the process that occurred with respect to blacks and priesthood. So you can't pin a single label on it. And that, if you get that message, then you got the essence of what I'm trying to get across. You can't put it into a single pigeonhole. The voices come in various manners and from different directions. Thank you for your time.
This has been a fabulous experience, and thanks so much, Brother Prince. I'm definitely going to have him sign this book for me. There are others available. Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight.